me, I love you, would it be right to answer, are you serious, or are you just playing with me? After all, if this relationship is to flourish, I very much hope that she is not serious, and that she will play with me. No, the better question would be, are you sincere, or are you just toying with me? Sincerity is better than seriousness, for who wants to be loved gravely? Thus, on the other hand, there is a form of playing which is not trivial at all, as when Segovia plays the guitar, or Sir Laurence Olivier plays the part of Hamlet, or, obviously, when someone plays the organ in church. In this sense of the word, St. Gregory Nazianzen could say of the Logos, the creative wisdom of God, for the Logos on high plays, stirring the whole cosmos back and forth, as he wills, into shapes of every kind. And at the other end of the earth, the Japanese Zen master Hakuin. In singing and dancing is the voice of the law. So too, in the Vedanta, the whole world is seen as the lila and the maya of the self, the first word meaning play, and the second having the complex sense of illusion, from the Latin ludere, to play, magic, creative power, art, and measuring, as when one dances or draws a design to a certain measure. From this point of view, the universe in general and playing in particular are, in a special sense, meaningless. That is, they do not, like words and symbols, signify or point to something beyond themselves, just as a Mozart sonata conveys no moral or social message and does not try to suggest the natural sounds of wind, thunder, or birdsong. When I make the sound water, you know what I mean. But what does this whole situation mean? I making the sound and your understanding it. What is the meaning of a pelican, a sunflower, a sea urchin, a mottled stone, or a galaxy, or of A plus B equals B plus A? They are all patterns, dancing patterns of light and sound, water and fire, rhythm and vibration, electricity and space-time, going like thrumula, thrumula, thrilp, hum lipsible, lipsible, lilp, dim thricken, mithrummy, lum gumptulous, hummy, storm gurgle, umbundula, bilp. Or, in the famous words of Sir Arthur Eddington about the nature of electrons, we see the atoms with their girdles of circulating electrons darting hither and thither, colliding and rebounding. Free electrons, torn from the girdles, hurry away 100 times faster. Curving sharply round the atoms with sideslips and hairbreadth escapes. The spectacle is so fascinating that we have perhaps forgotten that there was a time when we wanted to be told what an electron is. The question was never answered. Something unknown is doing we don't know what. That is what our theory amounts to. It does not sound a particularly illuminating theory. I have read something like it elsewhere. The stithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. There is the same suggestion of activity. There is the same indefiniteness as to the nature of the activity and of what it is that is acting. The Nature of the Physical World, J.M. Dent. The point is that spectacle is so fascinating. For the world is a spell, in Latin, fascinum, an enchantment, being thrilled by a chant, an amazement, being lost in a maze, an arabesque of such stunning rhythm and a plot so intriguing that we are drawn by its web into a state of involvement where we forget that it is a game. We become fascinated to the point where the cheering and the booing are transformed into intense love and hate, or delight and terror, ecstatic orgasm or screaming memes, all made out of on and off, or black and white, pulsed, stuttered, diagrammed, mosaiced, syncopated, shaded, jolted, tangoed, and lilted through all possible measures and dimensions. It is simultaneously the purest nonsense and the utmost artistry. Listen intently to a voice singing without words. It may charm you into crying, force you to dance, fill you with rage, or make you jump for joy. You can't tell where the music ends and the emotions begin, for the whole thing is a kind of music. The voice playing on your nerves as the breath plays on a flute. All experience is just that, except that its music has many more dimensions than sound. It vibrates in the dimensions of sight, touch, taste, and smell, and in the intellectual dimension of symbols and words, all evoking and playing upon each other. But at root, and this is a negative way of saying something highly positive, it is nothing more than the mysterious utterance of the old man of Spithead, who opened the window and said, "Fill jumble, fill jumble, fill rumble, come tumble." Bach states it more elegantly, but with just as little external meaning. Once you have seen this, you can return to the world of practical affairs with a new spirit. You have seen that the universe is, at root, a magical illusion and a fabulous game, and that there is no separate you to get something out of it, as if life were a bank to be robbed. The only real you is the one that comes and goes, manifests and withdraws itself eternally in and as every conscious being. For you is the universe looking at itself from billions of points of view, points that come and go so that the vision is forever new. What we see as death, empty space or nothingness, is only the trough between the crests of this endlessly waving ocean. It is all part of the illusion that there should seem to be something to be gained in the future, and that there is an urgent necessity to go on and on until we get it. Yet just as there is no time but the present, and no one except the all and everything, there is never anything to be gained, though the zest of the game is to pretend that there is. Anyone who brags about knowing this doesn't understand it, for he is only using the theory as a trick to maintain his illusion of separateness, a gimmick in a game of spiritual one-upmanship. Moreover, such bragging is deeply offensive to those who do not understand and who honestly believe themselves to be lonely, individual spirits in a desperate and agonizing struggle for life. For all such, there must be deep and unpatronizing compassion, even a special kind of reverence and respect, because, after all, in them, the self is playing its most far-out and daring game, the game of having lost itself completely and of being in danger of some total and irremediable disaster. This is why Hindus do not shake hands on meeting, but put their palms together and bow in a gesture of reverence, honoring the Godhead in the stranger. And do not suppose that this understanding will transform you all at once into a model of virtue. I have never yet met a saint or sage who did not have some human frailties. For so long as you manifest yourself in human or animal form, you must eat at the expense of other life and accept the limitations of your particular organism, which fire will still burn and wherein danger will still secrete adrenaline. The morality that goes with this understanding is, above all, the frank recognition of your dependence upon enemies, underlings, outgroups, and, indeed, upon all other forms of life whatsoever. Involved as you may be in the conflicts and competitive games of practical life, you will never again be able to indulge in the illusion that the offensive other is all in the wrong, and could or should be wiped out. This will give you the priceless ability of being able to contain conflicts so that they do not get out of hand, of being willing to compromise and adapt, of playing, yes, but playing it cool. This is what is called honor among thieves, for the really dangerous people are those who do not recognize that they are thieves, the unfortunates who play the role of the good guys with such blind zeal that they are unconscious of any indebtedness to the bad guys who support their status. To paraphrase the gospel, love your competitors and pray for those who undercut your prices. You would be nowhere at all without them. The political and personal morality of the West, especially in the United States, is, for lack of this sense, utterly schizophrenic. It is a monstrous combination of uncompromising idealism and unscrupulous gangsterism, and thus devoid of the humor and humaneness which enables confessed rascals to sit down together and work out reasonable deals. No one can be moral, that is, no one can harmonize contained conflicts, without coming to a working arrangement between the angel in himself and the devil in himself, between his rose above and his manure below. The two forces or tendencies are mutually interdependent, and the game is a working game just so long as the angel is winning but does not win, and the devil is losing but is never lost. The game doesn't work in reverse, just as the ocean doesn't work with wave crests down and troughs up. It is important that this be understood by those concerned with civil rights, international peace, and the restraint of nuclear weapons. These are most undoubtedly causes to be backed with full vigor, but but never in a spirit which fails to honour the opposition, or which regards it as entirely evil or insane. It is not without reason that the formal rules of boxing, judo, fencing, and even dueling require that the combatants salute each other before the engagement. In any foreseeable future, there are going to be thousands and thousands of people who detest and abominate Negroes, communists, Russians, Chinese, Jews, Catholics, beatniks, homosexuals, and dope fiends. These hatreds are not going to be healed, but only inflamed by insulting those who feel them, and the abusive labels with which we plaster them. Squares, fascists, rightists, know-nothings, may well become the proud badges and symbols around which they will rally and consolidate themselves. Nor will it do to confront the opposition in public with polite and non-violent sit-ins and demonstrations, while boosting our collective ego by insulting them in private. If we want justice for minorities and cooled wars with our natural enemies, whether human or non-human, we must first come to terms with the minority and the enemy in ourselves and in our own hearts. For the rascal is there as much as anywhere in the external world, especially when you realize that the world outside your skin is as much yourself as the world inside. For want of this awareness, no one can be more belligerent than a pacifist on the rampage, or more militantly nationalistic than an anti-imperialist. You may indeed argue that this is asking too much. You may resort to the old alibi that the task of changing human nature is too arduous and too slow, and that what we need is immediate and massive action. Obviously, it takes discipline to make any radical change in one's own behavior patterns, and psychotherapy can drag on for years and years. But this is not my suggestion. Does it really take any considerable time or effort just to understand that you depend on enemies and outsiders to define yourself, and that without some opposition, you would be lost? To see this is to acquire, almost instantly, the virtue of humor, and humor and self-righteousness are mutually exclusive. Humor is the twinkle in the eye of a just judge, who knows that he is also the felon in the dock. How could he be sitting there in stately judgment, being addressed as Your Honor or Milud, without those poor bastards being dragged before him day after day? It does not undermine his work and his function to recognize this. He plays the role of judge all the better for realizing that on the next turn of the Wheel of Fortune, he may be the accused, and that if all the truth were known, he would be standing there now. If this is cynicism, it is at least loving cynicism, an attitude and an atmosphere that cools off human conflicts more effectively than any amount of physical or moral violence. For it recognizes that the real goodness of human nature is its peculiar balance of love and selfishness, reason and passion, spirituality and sensuality, mysticism and materialism, in which the positive pole has always a slight edge over the negative. Were it otherwise, and the two were equally balanced, life would come to a total stalemate and standstill. Thus, when the two poles, good and bad, forget their interdependence and try to obliterate each other, man becomes subhuman, the implacable crusader, or the cold, sadistic thug. It is not for man to be either an angel or a devil, and the would-be angels should realize that, as their ambition succeeds, they evoke hordes of devils to keep the balance. This was the lesson of Prohibition, as of all other attempts to enforce purely angelic behavior or to pluck out evil root and branch. It comes, then, to this, that to be viable, livable, or merely practical, life must be lived as a game, and the must here expresses a condition, not a commandment. It must be lived in the spirit of play rather than work, and the conflicts which it involves must be carried on in the realization that no species or party to a game can survive without its natural antagonists, its beloved enemies, its indispensable opponents. For to love your enemies is to love them as enemies. It is not necessarily a clever device for winning them over to your own side. The lion lies down with the lamb in paradise, but not on earth. Paradise being the tacit, offstage level where, behind the scenes, all conflicting parties recognize their interdependence and, through this recognition, are able to keep their conflicts within bounds. This recognition is the absolutely essential chivalry which must set the limits within all warfare, with human and non-human enemies alike, For chivalry is the debonair spirit of the knight who plays with his life in the knowledge that even mortal combat is a game. No one who has been hoaxed into the belief that he is nothing but his ego or nothing but his individual organism can be chivalrous, let alone a civilized, sensitive, and intelligent member of the cosmos. But to be lived this way, the life game has to be purged of self-contradictory rules. This, and not some kind of moral effort, is the way out of the hoax of separateness. Thus, when a game sets the players an impossible and not simply difficult task, it comes quickly to the point where it is no longer worth playing. There is no way of observing a rule set in the form of a double bind, that is, a two-part rule, whose parts are mutually exclusive. No one can be compelled to behave freely or forced to act independently. Yet whole cultures and civilizations have befuddled themselves with this kind of nonsense, and through failing to spot the self-contradiction, their members have been haunted all through their lives by the sense that individual existence is a problem and a predicament, a form of nature doomed to perpetual frustration. The sense of ego is at root a discomfort and a bore, and nothing shows it more clearly than such everyday phrases as, "I need to get away from myself," or "you should find something to take you out of yourself," or "I read to forget myself." Get lost. Hence the fanaticisms and intoxications, religious, political, and sexual, the Nazis, the Klan, Hell's Angels, the Circus Maximus, the dreary fascination of the TV screen, witch burnings, Mickey Spillane and James Bond, pachinko parlors, alcoholic stupors, revivals, tabloid newspapers, and juvenile gangs, all of which, as things stand, are the necessary safety values and palliatives for human beings whose very existence is defined in self-contradictory and self-defeating terms. Finally, the game of life, as Western man has been playing it for the past century, needs less emphasis on practicality, results, progress, and aggression. This is why I am discussing vision, and keeping off the subject of justifying the vision in terms of its practical applications and consequences. Whatever may be true for the Chinese and the Hindus, it is timely for us to recognize that the future is an ever-retreating mirage, and to switch our immense energy and technical skill to contemplation instead of action. However much we may now disagree with Aristotle's logic and his metaphors, he must still be respected for reminding us that the goal of action is always contemplation, knowing and being, rather than seeking and becoming. As it is, we are merely bolting our lives, gulping down undigested experiences as fast as we can stuff them in, because awareness of our own existence is so superficial and so narrow that nothing seems to us more boring than simple being. If I ask you what you did, saw, heard, smelled, touched, and tasted yesterday, I am likely to get nothing more than the thin, sketchy outline of the few things that you noticed, and of those, only what you thought worth remembering. Is it surprising that an existence so experienced seems so empty and bare that its hunger for an infinite future is insatiable? But suppose you could answer, "It would take me forever to tell you, and I am much too interested in what's happening now." How is it possible that a being with such sensitive jewels as the eyes, such enchanted musical instruments as the ears, and such a fabulous arabesque of nerves as the brain can experience itself as anything less than a god? And when you consider that this incalculably subtle organism is inseparable from the still more marvelous patterns of its environment, from the minutest electrical designs to the whole company of the galaxies, how is it conceivable that this incarnation of all eternity can be bored with being? 6. It. Just as true humor is laughter at oneself, true humanity is knowledge of oneself. Other creatures may love and laugh, talk and think, but it seems to be the special peculiarity of human beings that they reflect. They think about thinking and know that they know.